Ladies and gentlemen, please join us for Radio Lillooet's special presentation of the Personal Recollections of Joan of Arc by Mark Twain.
Personal Recollections of Joan of Arc by Mark Twain, Book 2, Chapter 5, We Pierce the Last Ambuscades. We rested and otherwise refreshed ourselves 2 or 3 hours at Gien, but by that time the news was abroad that the young girl commissioned of God to deliver France was come. Wherefore such a press of people flocked to our quarters to get sight of her that it seemed best to seek a quieter place. So we pushed on and halted at a small village called Fierbois. We were now within 6 leagues of the king, who was at the castle of Chinon. Joan dictated a letter to him at once, and I wrote it. In it she said she had come 150 leagues to bring him good news, and begged the privilege of delivering it in person. She added that although she had never seen him, she would know him in any disguise, and would point him out. The 2 knights rode away at once with the letter. The troop slept all the afternoon, and after supper we felt pretty fresh and fine, especially our little group of young Domremiens. We had the comfortable tap-room of the village inn to ourselves, and for the first time in 10 unspeakably long days were exempt from bodings and terrors and hardships and fatiguing labors. The paladin was suddenly become his ancient self again, and was swaggering up and down, a very monument of self-complacency. Noel Regisson said, "I think it is wonderful the way he has brought us through."
"Who?" asked Jean.
"Why, the paladin."
The paladin seemed not to hear.
"What had he to do with it?" asked Pierre d'Arc. "Everything. It was nothing but Joan's confidence in his discretion that enabled her to keep up her heart. She could depend on us and on herself for valor, but discretion is the winning thing in war, after all. Discretion is the rarest and loftiest of qualities, and he has got more of it than any other man in France, more of it, perhaps, than any other 60 men in France."
"Now you are getting ready to make a fool of yourself, Noel Rengesson," said the paladin, "and you want to coil some of that long tongue of yours around your neck and stick the end of it in your ear. Then you'll be the less likely to get into trouble."
"I didn't know he had more discretion than other people," said Pierre, "for discretion argues brains, and he hasn't any more brains than the rest of us, in my opinion."
"No, you are wrong there. Discretion hasn't anything to do with brains. Brains are an obstruction to it, for it does not reason, it feels. Perfect discretion means absence of brains. Discretion is a quality of the heart, solely a quality of the heart. It acts upon us through feeling. We know this, because if it were an intellectual quality, it would only perceive a danger, for instance, where a danger exists, whereas—"
"Hear him twaddle, the damned idiot," muttered the paladin.
"Whereas it being purely a quality of the heart, and proceeding by feeling, not reason, its reach is correspondingly wider and sublimer, enabling it to perceive and avoid dangers that haven't any existence at all. As, for instance, that night in the fog when the paladin took his horse's ears for hostile lances, and got off and climbed a tree."
"It's a lie without shadow of foundation, and I call upon you all to beware you give credence to the malicious inventions of this ramshackle slander-mill that has been doing its best to destroy my character for years, and will grind up your own reputations for you next. I got off to tighten my saddle-girth. I wish I may die in my tracks if it isn't so, and whoever wants to believe it can, and whoever don't can let it alone."
"There, that is the way with him, you see. He never can discuss a theme temperately, but always flies off the handle and becomes disagreeable. And you notice his defect of memory. He remembers getting off his horse, and forgets all the rest, even the tree.
But that is natural. He would remember getting off the horse because he was so used to doing it. He always did it when there was an alarm and the clash of arms at the front."
"Why did he choose that time for it?" asked Jean.
"I don't know. To tighten up his girth, he thinks, to climb a tree, I think. I saw him climb 9 trees in a single night."
"You saw nothing of the kind. A person that can lie like that deserves no one's respect. I ask you all to answer me. Do you believe what this reptile has said?"
All seemed embarrassed, and only Pierre replied. He said hesitatingly,
"I hardly know what to say.
It is a delicate situation. It seems offensive to me to refuse to believe a person when he makes so direct a statement, and yet I am obliged to say, rude as it may appear, that I am not able to believe the whole of it. No, I am not able to believe that you climbed 9 trees.
There, cried the paladin. Now what do you think of yourself, Noel Rainguesson? How many do you believe I climbed, Pierre?
Only 8.
The laughter that followed inflamed the paladin's anger to white heat, and he said,
I bide my time. I bide my time. I will reckon with you all, I promise you that.
Don't get him started, Noel pleaded. He is a perfect lion when he gets started. I saw enough to teach me that after the 3rd skirmish. After it was over, I saw him come out of the bushes and attack a dead man single-handed.
It is another lie, and I give you fair warning that you are going too far. You will see me attack a live one if you are not careful.
Meaning me, of course. This wounds me more than any number of injurious and unkind speeches could do. In gratitude to one's benefactor—
Benefactor? What do I owe you, I should like to know?
You owe me your life. I stood between the trees and the foe, and kept hundreds and thousands of the enemy at bay when they were thirsting for your blood. And I did not do it to display my daring. I did it because I loved you, and could not live without you.
There, you have said enough. I will not stay here to listen to these infamies. I can endure your lies, but not your love. Keep that corruption for somebody with a stronger stomach than mine. And I want to say this before I go, that you people's small performances might appear the better and win you the more glory. I hid my own deeds through all the march. I went always to the front, where the fighting was thickest, to be remote from you in order that you might not see and be discouraged by the things I did to the enemy. It was my purpose to keep this a secret in my own breast, but you force me to reveal it. If you ask for my witnesses, yonder they lie, on the road we have come. I found that road mud. I paved it with corpses. I found that country sterile. I fertilized it with blood. Time and again I was urged to go to the rear because the command could not proceed on account of my dead, and yet you, you miscreant, accuse me of climbing trees. Pah!
He strode off with a lofty air, for the recital of his imaginary deeds had already set him up again and made him feel good. Next day we mounted and faced toward Chinon. Orléans was at our back now, and close by, lying in the strangling grip of the English. Soon, please God, we would face about and go to their relief. From Gien the news had spread to Orléans that the peasant maid of Vaucouleurs was on her way, divinely commissioned to raise the siege. The news made a great excitement and raised a great hope, the first breath of hope those poor souls had breathed in 5 months. They sent commissioners at once to the king to beg him to consider this matter and not throw this help lightly away. These commissioners were already at Chinon by this time. When we were halfway to Chinon, we happened upon yet one more squad of enemies. They burst suddenly out of the woods, and in considerable force, too. But we were not the apprentices we were 10 or 12 days before. No, we were seasoned to this kind of adventure now. Our hearts did not jump into our throats, and our weapons trembled in our hands. We had learned to be always in battle array, always alert, and always ready to deal with any emergency that might turn up. We were no more dismayed by the sight of those people than our commander was. Before they could form, Joan had delivered the order, "Forward!" and we were down upon them with a rush. They stood no chance. They turned tail and scattered, we plowing through them as if they had been men of straw. That was our last ambuscade, and it was probably laid for us by that treacherous rascal, the king's own minister and favorite, de la Tremouille. We housed ourselves in an inn, and soon the town came flocking to get a glimpse of the maid. Ah, the tedious king and his tedious people! Our 2 good knights came presently, their patience well wearied, and reported. They and we reverently stood, as becomes persons who are in the presence of kings and the superiors of kings, until Joan, troubled by this mark of homage and respect, and not content with it nor yet used to it, although we had not permitted ourselves to do otherwise since the day she prophesied that wretched traitor's death, and he was straightway drowned, thus confirming many previous signs that she was indeed an ambassador commissioned of God, commanded us to sit. Then the Sieur de Metz said to Joan, "The king has got the letter, but they will not let us have speech with him."
"Who is it that forbids?"
None forbids, but there be three or four that are nearest his person, schemers and traitors every one, that put obstructions in the way, and seek all ways, by lies and pretexts, to make delay. Chiefest of these are George de la Tremouille, and that plotting fox the Archbishop of Reims. While they keep the king idle and in bondage to his sports and follies, they are great and their importance grows. Whereas, if ever he assert himself, and rise and strike for crown and country like a man, their reign is done. So they but thrive. They care not if the crown go to destruction and the king with it.
You have spoken with others besides these?
Not of the court, no. The court are the meek slaves of those reptiles, and watch their mouths and their actions, acting as they act, thinking as they think, saying as they say. Wherefore they are cold to us, and turn aside and go another way when we appear. But we have spoken with the commissioners from Orleans. They said with heat, "It is a marvel that any man in such desperate case as is the king can moon around in this torpid way, and see his all go to ruin without lifting a finger to stay the disaster. What a most strange spectacle it is! Here he is, shut up in this wee corner of the realm like a rat in a trap. His royal shelter, this huge gloomy tomb of a castle, with wormy rags for upholstery and crippled furniture for use, a very house of desolation. In his treasure 40 francs, and not a farthing more, God be witness. No army, nor any shadow of one. And by contrast with his hungry poverty, you behold this crownless pauper and his shoals of fools and favorites, tricked out in the gaudiest silks and velvets you shall find in any court in Christendom. And look you, he knows that when our city falls, as fall it surely will, except succor come swiftly, France falls. He knows that when that day comes, he will be an outlaw and a fugitive, and that behind him the English flag will float unchallenged over every acre of his great heritage. He knows these things. He knows that our faithful city is fighting all solitary and alone against disease, starvation, and the sword to stay this awful calamity, yet he will not strike one blow to save her. He will not hear our prayers, he will not even look upon our faces." That is what the commissioners said, and they are in despair. Joan said gently, "It is a pity, but they must not despair. The Dauphin will hear them presently. Tell them so." She almost always called the king the Dauphin. To her mind, he was not king yet, not being crowned. "We will tell them so, and it will content them, for they believe you come from God. The Archbishop and his confederate have for backer that veteran soldier Raoul de Gaucourt, Grand Master of the Palace, a worthy man, but simply a soldier, with no head for any great matter. He cannot make out to see how a country girl, ignorant of war, can take a sword in her small hand and win victories where the trained generals of France have looked for defeats only for 50 years, and always found them. And so he lifts his frosty mustache and scoffs. When God fights, it is but small matter whether the hand that bears his sword is big or little. He will perceive this in time. Is there none in that castle of Chinon who favors us?
Yes, the king's mother-in-law, Yolande, Queen of Sicily, who is wise and good.
She spoke with the Sieur Bertrand.
She favors us, and she hates those others, the king's beguilers, said Bertrand. She was full of interest and asked 1,000 questions, all of which I answered according to my ability. Then she sat thinking over these replies until I thought she was lost in a dream and would wake no more. But it was not so. At last she said slowly, and as if she were talking to herself,
"A child of 17, a girl, country-bred, untaught, ignorant of war, the use of arms, and the conduct of battles, modest, gentle, shrinking, yet throws away her shepherd's crook and clothes herself in steel, and fights her way through 150 leagues of fear, and comes, she to whom a king must be a dread and awful presence, and will stand up before such an one and say, 'Be not afraid, God has sent me to save you.' Ah, whence could come a courage and conviction so sublime as this, but from very God himself?"
She was silent again a while, thinking and making up her mind, and then she said,
"And whether she comes of God or no, there is that in her heart that raises her above men.
high above all men that breathe in France to-day. For in her is that mysterious something that puts her heart into soldiers, and turns mobs of cowards into armies of fighters that forget what fear is when they are in that presence. Fighters who go into battle with joy in their eyes and songs on their lips, and sweep over the field like a storm. That is the spirit that can save France, and that alone, come it whence it may. It is in her, I do truly believe, for what else could have borne up that child on that great march, and made her despise its dangers and fatigues? The king must see her face to face, and shall.
She dismissed me with those good words, and I know her promise will be kept. They will delay her all they can, those animals, but she will not fail in the end.
"Would she were king," said the other knight fervently, "for there is little hope that the king himself can be stirred out of his lethargy. He is wholly without hope, and is only thinking of throwing away everything and flying to some foreign land. The commissioners say there is a spell upon him that makes him hopeless, yes, and that it is shut up in a mystery which they cannot fathom."
"I know the mystery," said Joan, with quiet confidence. "I know it, and he knows it. But no other but God. When I see him, I will tell him a secret that will drive away his trouble. Then he will hold up his head again."
I was miserable with curiosity to know what it was that she would tell him, but she did not say, and I did not expect she would. She was but a child, it is true, but she was not a chatterer to tell great matters and make herself important to little people. No, she was reserved, and kept things to herself, as the truly great always do. The next day Queen Yolande got one victory over the king's keepers, for, in spite of their protestations and obstructions, she procured an audience for our two knights, and they made the most they could out of their opportunity. They told the king what a spotless and beautiful character Joan was, and how great and noble a spirit animated her, and they implored him to trust in her, believe in her, and have faith that she was sent to save France. They begged him to consent to see her. He was strongly moved to do this, and promised that he would not drop the matter out of his mind, but would consult with his council about it. This began to look encouraging. 2 hours later there was a great stir below, and the innkeeper came flying up to say a commission of illustrious ecclesiastics was come from the king. From the king his very self, understand. Think of this vast honor to his humble little hostelry, and he was so overcome with the glory of it that he could hardly find breath enough in his excited body to put the facts into words. They were come from the king to speak with the maid of Vaucouleurs. Then he flew downstairs, and presently appeared again, backing into the room, and bowing to the ground with every step, in front of four imposing and austere bishops and their train of servants. Joan rose, and we all stood. The bishops took seats, and for a while no word was said, for it was their prerogative to speak first, and they were so astonished to see what a child it was that was making such a noise in the world and degrading personages of their dignity to the base function of ambassadors to her in her plebeian tavern, that they could not find any words to say at first. Then presently their spokesman told Joan they were aware that she had a message for the king, wherefore she was now commanded to put it into words, briefly, and without waste of time or embroideries of speech. As for me, I could hardly contain my joy. Our message was to reach the king at last, and there was the same joy and pride and exultation in the faces of our knights, too, and in those of Joan's brothers, and I knew that they were all praying as I was, that the awe which we felt in the presence of these great dignitaries, and which would have tied our tongues and locked our jaws, would not affect her in the like degree, but that she would be enabled to word her message well and with little stumbling, and so make a favorable impression here, where it would be so valuable and so important. Ah, dear, how little we were expecting what happened then! We were aghast to hear her say what she said. She was standing in a reverent attitude, with her head down and her hands clasped in front of her, for she was always reverent toward the consecrated servants of God. When the spokesman had finished, she raised her head and set her calm eye on those faces, not any more disturbed by their state and grandeur than a princess would have been, and said, with all her ordinary simplicity and modesty of voice and manner,
"Ye will forgive me, reverend sirs, but I have no message save for the king's ear alone." Those surprised men were dumb for a moment, and their faces flushed darkly. Then the spokesman said, "Hark ye! Do you fling the king's command in his face and refuse to deliver this message of yours to his servants appointed to receive it?"
"God has appointed me to receive it, and another's commandment may not take precedence of that. I pray you let me have speech for his grace the Dauphin."
"Forbear this folly, and come at your message. Deliver it, and waste no more time about it."
"You err indeed, most reverend fathers in God, and it is not well. I am not come hither to talk, but to deliver Orleans, and lead the Dauphin to his good city of Reims, and set the crown upon his head."
"Is that the message you send to the king?"
But Joan only said, in the simple fashion which was her wont, "You will pardon me for reminding you again, but I have no message to send to any one."
The king's messengers rose in deep anger and swept out of the place without further words, we and Joan kneeling as they passed.
Our countenances were vacant, our hearts full of a sense of disaster. Our precious opportunity was thrown away. We could not understand Joan's conduct, she who had been so wise until this fatal hour. At last the Sieur Bertrand found courage to ask her why she had let this great chance to get her message to the king go by. "Who sent them here?" she asked.
"The king."
"Who moved the king to send them?"
She waited for an answer. None came, for we began to see what was in her mind. So she answered herself.
"The Dauphin's council moved him to it. Are they enemies to me and to the Dauphin's weal, or are they friends?"
"Enemies," answered the Sieur Bertrand.
"If one would have a message go sound and ungarbled, does one choose traitors and tricksters to send it by?"
I saw that we had been fools, and she wise. They saw it too, so none found anything to say. Then she went on.
"They had but small wit that contrived this trap. They thought to get my message and seem to deliver it straight, yet deftly twist it from its purpose. You know that one part of my message is but this, to move the Dauphin by argument and reasonings to give me men-at-arms and send me to the siege. If an enemy carried these in the right words, the exact words, and no word missing, yet left out the persuasions of gesture and supplicating tone and beseeching looks that inform the words and make them live, where were the value of that argument? Whom could it convince? Be patient. The Dauphin will hear me presently. Have no fear."
The Sieur de Metz nodded his head several times and muttered as to himself, "She was right and wise, and we are but dull fools, when all is said."
"It was just my thought. I could have said it myself, and indeed it was the thought of all there present. A sort of awe crept over us, to think how that untaught girl, taken suddenly and unprepared, was yet able to penetrate the cunning devices of a king's trained advisers and defeat them. Marveling over this and astonished at it, we fell silent and spoke no more. We had come to know that she was great in courage, fortitude, endurance, patience, conviction, fidelity to all duties, in all things, indeed, that make a good and trusty soldier and perfect him for his post. Now we were beginning to feel that maybe there were greatnesses in her brain that were even greater than these great qualities of the heart. It set us thinking. What Joan did that day bore fruit the very day after. The king was obliged to respect the spirit of a young girl who could hold her own and stand her ground like that, and he asserted himself sufficiently to put his respect into an act instead of into polite and empty words. He moved Joan out of that poor inn and housed her with us, her servants, in the castle of Cordray, personally confiding her to the care of Madame de Bellier, wife of old Raoul de Gaucourt, master of the palace. Of course, this royal attention had an immediate result. All the great lords and ladies of the court began to flock there to see and listen to the wonderful girl soldier that all the world was talking about, and who had answered the king's mandate with a bland refusal to obey. Joan charmed them, every one, with her sweetness and simplicity and unconscious eloquence, and all the best and capablest among them recognized that there was an indefinable something about her that testified that she was not made of common clay, that she was built on a grander plan than the mass of mankind, and moved on a loftier plane. These spread her fame. She always made friends and advocates that way. Neither the high nor the low could come within the sound of her voice and the sight of her face, and go out from her presence indifferent.
End of chapter 5.
Radio Lilu 100.5 FM.
无线电力卢克100.5 FM.
Radio Lilu so on Banjo FM.
Radio Lilu 100.5 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 FM.
Doesn't matter how you say it or where you come from. This is Radio Lillooet 100.5 FM.
Personal Recollections of Joan of Arc by Mark Twain, Book 2, Chapter 6, Joan Convinces the King.
Well, anything to make delay, the King's Council advised him against arriving at a decision in our matter too precipitately. He arrive at a decision too precipitately? So they sent a committee of priests, always priests, into Lorraine to inquire into Joan's character and history, a matter which would consume several weeks, of course. You see how fastidious they were. It was as if people should come to put out the fire when a man's house was burning down, and they waited till they could send into another county to find out if he had always kept the Sabbath or not, before letting him try. So the days poked along. Dreary for us young people in some ways, but not in all, for we had one great anticipation in front of us. We had never seen a king, and now, some day, we should have that prodigious spectacle to see and to treasure in our memories all our lives. So we were on the lookout, and always eager and watching for the chance. The others were doomed to wait longer than I, as it turned out. One day great news came. The Orleans commissioners, with Yolande and our knights, had at last turned the council's position and persuaded the king to see Joan. Joan received the immense news gratefully, but without losing her head. But with us others it was otherwise. We could not eat or sleep or do any rational thing for the excitement and the glory of it. During 2 days our pair of noble knights were in distress and trepidation on Joan's account, for the audience was to be at night, and they were afraid that Joan would be so paralyzed by the glare of light from the long files of torches, the solemn pomps and ceremonies, the great concourse of renowned personages, the brilliant costumes, and the other splendors of the court, that she, a simple country maid, and all unused to such things, would be overcome by these terrors and make a piteous failure. No doubt I could have comforted them, but I was not free to speak. Would Joan be disturbed by this cheap spectacle, this tinsel show with its small king and his butterfly dukelets? She who had spoken face to face with the princes of heaven, the familiars of God, and seen their retinue of angels stretching back into the remoteness of the sky, myriads upon myriads, like a measureless fan of light, a glory like the glory of the sun streaming from each of those innumerable heads, the massed radiance filling the deeps of space with a blinding splendor? I thought not. Queen Yolande wanted Joan to make the best possible impression upon the king and the court, so she was strenuous to have her clothed in the richest stuffs, wrought upon the princeliest pattern, and set off with jewels. But in that she had to be disappointed, of course, Joan not being persuadable to it, but begging to be simply and sincerely dressed, as became a servant of God, and one sent upon a mission of a serious sort and grave political import. So then the gracious queen imagined and contrived that simple and witching costume which I have described to you so many times, and which I cannot think of even now in my dull age without being moved just as rhythmical and exquisite music moves me. For that was music, that dress. That is what it was, music that one saw with the eyes and felt in the heart. Yes, she was a poem. She was a dream. She was a spirit when she was clothed in that. She kept that raiment always, and wore it several times upon occasions of state, and it is preserved to this day in the treasury of Orléans, with two of her swords, and her banner, and other things now sacred because they had belonged to her. At the appointed time, the Count of Vendôme, a great lord of the court, came richly clothed with his train of servants and assistants, to conduct Joan to the king, and the two knights and I went with her, being entitled to this privilege by reason of our official positions near her person. When we entered the great audience hall,
There it all was, just as I have already painted it. Here were ranks of guards in shining armor and with polished halberds. Two sides of the hall were like flower gardens for variety of color and the magnificence of the costumes. Light streamed upon these masses of color from 250 flambeaux. There was a wide, free space down the middle of the hall, and at the end of it was a throne royally canopied, and upon it sat a crowned and sceptered figure, nobly clothed and blazing with jewels. It is true that Joan had been hindered and put off a good while, but now that she was admitted to an audience at last, she was received with honors granted to only the greatest personages. At the entrance door stood four heralds in a row, in splendid tabards, with long, slender silver trumpets at their mouths, with square silken banners depending from them embroidered with the arms of France. As Joan and the Count passed by, these trumpets gave forth in unison one long, rich note, and as we moved down the hall under the pictured and gilded vaulting, this was repeated at every 50 feet of our progress, 6 times in all. It made our good knights proud and happy, and they held themselves erect, and stiffened their stride, and looked fine and soldierly. They were not expecting this beautiful and honorable tribute to our little country maid. Joan walked 2 yards behind the Count. We three walked 2 yards behind Joan. Our solemn march ended when we were as yet some 8 or 10 steps from the throne. The Count made a deep obeisance, pronounced Joan's name, then bowed again, and moved to his place among a group of officials near the throne. I was devouring the crowned personage with all my eyes, and my heart almost stood still with awe. The eyes of all others were fixed upon Joan in a gaze of wonder which was half worship, and which seemed to say, "How sweet, how lovely, how divine!" All lips were parted and motionless, which was a sure sign that those people who seldom forget themselves had forgotten themselves now, and were not conscious of anything but the one object they were gazing upon. They had the look of people who are under the enchantment of a vision. Then they presently began to come to life again, rousing themselves out of the spell, and shaking it off as one drives away little by little a clinging drowsiness or intoxication. Now they fixed their attention upon Joan with a strong new interest of another sort. They were full of curiosity to see what she would do, they having a secret and particular reason for this curiosity. So they watched. This is what they saw. She made no obeisance, nor even any slight inclination of her head, but stood looking toward the throne in silence. That was all there was to see at present. I glanced up at De Metz, and was shocked at the paleness of his face. I whispered and said, "What is it, man? What is it?" His answering whisper was so weak I could hardly catch it. "They have taken advantage of the hint in her letter to play a trick upon her. She will err, and they will laugh at her. That is not the king that sits there." Then I glanced at Joan. She was still gazing steadfastly toward the throne, and I had the curious fancy that even her shoulders and the back of her head expressed bewilderment. Now she turned her head slowly, and her eye wandered along the lines of standing courtiers till it fell upon a young man who was very quietly dressed. Then her face lighted joyously, and she ran and threw herself at his feet, and clasped his knees, exclaiming in that soft, melodious voice which was her birthright, and was now charged with deep and tender feeling, "God of His grace give you long life, O dear and gentle Dauphin!" In his astonishment and exultation, De Metz cried out, "By the shadow of God, it is an amazing thing!" Then he mashed all the bones of my hand in his grateful grip and added with a proud shake of his mane, "Now what have these painted infidels to say?" Meantime the young person in the plain clothes was saying to Joan, "Ah, you mistake, my child. I am not the king. There he is," and he pointed to the throne. The knight's face clouded, and he muttered in grief and indignation, "Ah, it is a shame to use her so. But for this lie she had gone through safe. I will go and proclaim to all the house what—"
"Stay where you are,"
whispered I and the Sieur Bertrand in a breath, and made him stop in his place. Joan did not stir from her knees, but still lifted her happy face toward the king and said,
"No, gracious liege, you are he, and none other."
De Metz's troubles vanished away, and he said, "Verily, she was not guessing, she knew. Now, how could she know? It is a miracle. I am content and will meddle no more, for I perceive that she is equal to her occasions, having that in her head that cannot profitably be helped by the vacancy that is in mine. This interruption of his lost me a remark or two of the other talk. However, I caught the king's next question. But tell me who you are, and what would you?
I am called Joan the Maid, and am sent to say that the King of Heaven wills that you be crowned and consecrated in your good city of Reims, and be thereafter lieutenant of the Lord of Heaven, who is King of France. And he willeth also that you set me at my appointed work and give me men-at-arms.
After a slight pause she added, her eye lighting at the sound of her words, "For then I will raise the siege of Orléans and break the English power." The young monarch's amused face sobered a little when this martial speech fell upon that sick air like a breath blown from embattled camps and fields of war, and this trifling smile presently faded wholly away and disappeared. He was grave now and thoughtful. After a little he waved his hand lightly, and all the people fell away and left those two by themselves in a vacant space. The knights and I moved to the opposite side of the hall and stood there. We saw Joan rise at a sign. Then she and the king talked privately together. All that host had been consumed with curiosity to see what Joan would do. Well, they had seen, and now they were full of astonishment to see that she had really performed that strange miracle according to the promise in her letter, and they were fully as much astonished to find that she was not overcome by the pomps and splendors about her, but was even more tranquil and at her ease in holding speech with a monarch than ever they themselves had been, with all their practice and experience. As for our two knights, they were inflated beyond measure with pride in Joan, but nearly dumb as to speech, they not being able to think out any way to account for her managing to carry herself through this imposing ordeal without ever a mistake or an awkwardness of any kind to mar the grace and credit of her great performance. The talk between Joan and the king was long and earnest, and held in low voices. We could not hear, but we had our eyes and could note effects, and presently we and all the house noted one effect which was memorable and striking, and has been set down in memoirs and histories, and in testimony at the process of rehabilitation by some who witnessed it. For all knew it was big with meaning, though none knew what that meaning was at that time, of course. For suddenly we saw the king shake off his indolent attitude and straighten up like a man, and at the same time look immeasurably astonished. It was as if Joan had told him something almost too wonderful for belief, and yet of a most uplifting and welcome nature. It was long before we found out the secret of this conversation, but we know it now, and all the world knows it. That part of the talk was like this, as one may read in all histories. The perplexed king asked Joan for a sign. He wanted to believe in her and her mission, and that her voices were supernatural and endowed with knowledge hidden from mortals. But how could he do this unless these voices could prove their claim in some absolutely unassailable way? It was then that Joan said, "I will give you a sign, and you shall no more doubt. There is a secret trouble in your heart which you speak of to none, a doubt which wastes away your courage and makes you dream of throwing all away and fleeing from your realm. Within this little while you have been praying in your own breast that God of His grace would resolve that doubt, even if the doing of it must show you that no kingly right is lodged in you." It was that amazed the king, for it was as she had said, his prayer was the secret of his own breast, and none but God could know about it. So he said, "The sign is sufficient. I know now that these voices are of God. They have said true in this matter. If they have said more, tell it me. I will believe." "They have resolved that doubt, and I bring their very words, which are these: Thou art lawful heir to the king thy father, and true heir of France. God has spoken it. Now lift up thy head and doubt no more, but give me men-at-arms, and let me get about my work." Telling him he was of lawful birth was what straightened him up and made a man of him for a moment, removing his doubts upon that head and convincing him of his royal right. And if any could have hanged his hindering and pestiferous counsel and set him free, he would have answered Joan's prayer and set her in the field. But no, those creatures were only checked, not checkmated. They could invent some more delays. We had been made proud by the honors which had so distinguished Joan's entrance into that place, honors restricted to personages of very high rank and worth. But that pride was as nothing compared with the pride we had in the honor done her upon leaving it. For whereas those first honors were shown only to the great, these last, up to this time, had been shown only to the royal. The king himself led Joan by the hand down the great hall to the door, the glittering multitude standing and making reverence as they passed, and the silver trumpets sounding those rich notes of theirs. Then he dismissed her with gracious words, bending low over her hand and kissing it. Always, from all companies high or low, she went forth richer in honor and esteem than when she came. And the king did another handsome thing by Joan, for he sent us back to Courdray Castle, torch-lighted and in state, under escort of his own troop, his guard of honor, the only soldiers he had, and finely equipped and bedizened they were, too, though they hadn't seen the color of their wages since they were children, as a body might say. The wonders which Joan had been performing before the king had been carried all around by this time, so the road was so packed with people who wanted to get a sight of her that we could hardly dig through. And as for talking together, we couldn't, all attempts at talk being drowned in the storm of shoutings and huzzas that broke out all along as we passed, and kept abreast of us like a wave the whole way. End of Book Two, Chapter Six. Personal Recollections of Joan of Arc by Mark Twain, Chapter 7, Our Paladin in His Glory. We were doomed to suffer tedious waits and delays, and we settled ourselves down to our fate and bore it with a dreary patience, counting the slow hours and the dull days, and hoping for a turn when God should please to send it. The paladin was the only exception, that is to say, he was the only one who was happy and had no heavy times. This was partly owing to the satisfaction he got out of his clothes. He bought them at second hand, a Spanish cavalier's complete suit, wide-brimmed hat with flowing plumes, lace collar and cuffs, faded velvet doublet and trunks, short cloak hung from the shoulder, funnel-topped buskins, long rapier and all that, a graceful and picturesque costume, and the paladin's great frame was the right place to hang it for effect. He wore it when off duty, and when he swaggered by with one hand resting on the hilt of his rapier, and twirling his new mustache with the other, everybody stopped to look and admire. And well they might, for he was a fine and stately contrast to the small French gentleman of the day squeezed into the trivial French costume of the time. He was King Bee of the little village that snuggled under the shelter of the frowning towers and bastions of Courdray Castle, and acknowledged lord of the tap-room of the inn. When he opened his mouth there, he got a hearing. Those simple artisans and peasants listened with deep and wondering interest, for he was a traveler and had seen the world, all of it, that lay between Chinon and Domremy, at any rate, and that was a wide stretch more of it than they might ever hope to see. And he had been in battle, and knew how to paint its shock and struggle, its perils and surprises, with an art that was all his own. He was cock of that walk, hero of that hostelry. He drew custom as honey draw flies, so he was the pet of the innkeeper and of his wife and daughter, and they were his obliged and willing servants. Most people who have the narrative gift, that great and rare endowment, have with it the defect of telling their choice things over the same way every time, and this injures them and causes them to sound stale and wearisome after several repetitions. But it was not so with the paladin, whose art was of a finer sort. It was more stirring and interesting to hear him tell about a battle the tenth time than it was the first time, because he did not tell it twice the same way, but always made a new battle of it and a better one, with more casualties on the enemy's side each time, and more general wreck and disaster all around, and more widows and orphans and suffering in the neighborhood where it happened. He could not tell his battles apart himself, except by their names, and by the time he had told one of them 10 times, it had grown so that there wasn't room enough in France for it any more, but was lapping over the edges. But up to that point the audience would not allow him to substitute a new battle, knowing that the old ones were the best, and sure to improve as long as France could hold them.
And so, instead of saying to him, as they would have said to another, "Give us something fresh. We are fatigued with that old thing," they would say, with one voice and with a strong interest, "Tell about the surprise at Beaulieu again. Tell it three or four times." That is a compliment which few narrative experts have heard in their lifetime. At first, when the paladin heard us tell about the glories of the royal audience, he was broken-hearted because he was not taken with us to it. Next, his talk was full of what he would have done if he had been there, and within 2 days he was telling what he did do when he was there. His mill was fairly started now, and could be trusted to take care of its affair. Within 3 nights afterward, all his battles were taking a rest, for already his worshippers in the tap-room were so infatuated with the great tale of the royal audience that they would have nothing else, and so besotted with it were they that they would have cried if they could not have gotten it. Noel Rainguesson hid himself and heard it, and came and told me, and after that we went together to listen, bribing the inn hostess to let us have her little private parlor, where we could stand at the wickets in the door and see and hear. The tap-room was large, yet had a snug and cozy look, with its inviting little tables and chairs scattered irregularly over its red-brick floor, and its great fire flaming and crackling in the wide chimney. It was a comfortable place to be in on such chilly and blustering March nights as these, and a goodly company had taken shelter there, and were sipping their wine in contentment, and gossiping one with another in a neighborly way, while they waited for the historian. The host, the hostess, and their pretty daughter were flying here and there and yonder among the tables, and doing their best to keep up with the orders. The room was about 40 feet square, and a space or aisle down the center of it had been kept vacant and reserved for the paladin's needs. At the end of it was a platform 10 or 12 feet wide, with a big chair and a small table on it, and 3 steps leading up to it. Among the wine-sippers were many familiar faces: the cobbler, the farrier, the blacksmith, the wheelwright, the armorer, the maltster, the weaver, the baker, the miller's man with his dusty coat, and so on. And conscious and important, as a matter of course, was the barber-surgeon, for he is that in all villages, as he has to pull everybody's teeth and purge and bleed all the grown people once a month to keep their health sound. He knows everybody, and by constant contact with all sorts of folk becomes a master of etiquette and manners, and a conversationalist of large facility. There were plenty of carriers, drovers, and their sort, and journeymen artisans. When the paladin presently came sauntering indolently in, he was received with a cheer, and the barber hustled forward and greeted him with several low and most graceful and courtly bows, also taking his hand and touching his lips to it. Then he called in a loud voice for a stoup of wine for the paladin, and when the host's daughter brought it up on the platform, and dropped her courtesy and departed, the barber called after her, and told her to add the wine to his score. This won him ejaculations of approval, which pleased him very much, and made his little rat-eyes shine. And such applause is right and proper, for when we do a liberal and gallant thing, it is but natural that we should wish to see notice taken of it. The barber called upon the people to rise and drink the paladin's health, and they did it with alacrity and affectionate heartiness, clashing their metal flagons together with a simultaneous crash, and heightening the effect with a resounding cheer. It was a fine thing to see how that young swashbuckler had made himself so popular in a strange land in so little a while, and without other helps to his advancement than just his tongue, and the talent to use it given him by God, a talent which was but one talent in the beginning, but was now become 10 through husbandry and the increment and usufruct that do naturally follow that and reward it as by a law. The people sat down and began to hammer on the tables with their flagons and call for "The King's audience! The King's audience! The King's audience!" The paladin stood there in one of his best attitudes, with his plumed great hat tipped over to the left, the folds of his short cloak drooping from his shoulder, and the one hand resting upon the hilt of his rapier, and the other lifting his beaker. As the noise died down, he made a stately sort of a bow, which he had picked up somewhere, then fetched his beaker with a sweep to his lips, and tilted his head back and drained it to the bottom. The barber jumped for it and set it upon the paladin's table. Then the paladin began to walk up and down his platform with a great deal of dignity and quite at his ease.
and as he walked he talked, and every little while stopped and stood facing his house, and so standing continued his talk. We went three nights in succession. It was plain that there was a charm about the performance that was apart from the mere interest which attaches to lying. It was presently discoverable that this charm lay in the paladin's sincerity. He was not lying consciously. He believed what he was saying. To him his initial statements were facts, and whenever he enlarged a statement, the enlargement became a fact too. He put his heart into his extravagant narrative, just as a poet puts his heart into a heroic fiction, and his earnestness disarmed criticism, disarmed it as far as he himself was concerned. Nobody believed his narrative, but all believed that he believed it. He made his enlargements without flourish, without emphasis, and so casually that often one failed to notice that a change had been made. He spoke of the governor of Vaucouleurs the first night simply as the governor of Vaucouleurs. He spoke of him the second night as his uncle, the governor of Vaucouleurs. The third night he was his father. He did not seem to know that he was making these extraordinary changes. They dropped from his lips in a quite natural and effortless way. By his first night's account, the governor merely attached him to the maid's military escort in a general and unofficial way. The second night his uncle, the governor, sent him with the maid as lieutenant of her rear guard. The third night his father, the governor, put the whole command, maid and all, in his special charge. The first night the governor spoke of him as a youth without name or ancestry, but destined to achieve both. The second night his uncle, the governor, spoke of him as the latest and worthiest lineal descendant of the chiefest and noblest of the 12 paladins of Charlemagne. The third night he spoke of him as the lineal descendant of the whole dozen. In three nights he promoted the Count of Vendôme from a fresh acquaintance to a schoolmate, and then brother-in-law. At the king's audience everything grew in the same way. First, the four silver trumpets were 12, then 35, and finally 96. And by that time he had thrown in so many drums and cymbals that he had to lengthen the hall from 500 feet to 900 to accommodate them. Under his hand the people present multiplied in the same large way. The first two nights he contented himself with merely describing and exaggerating the chief dramatic incident of the audience, but the third night he added illustration to description. He throned the barber in his own high chair to represent the sham king. Then he told how the court watched the maid with intense interest and suppressed merriment, expecting to see her fooled by the deception, and get herself swept permanently out of credit by the storm of scornful laughter which would follow. He worked this scene up till he got his house in a burning fever of excitement and anticipation. Then came his climax. Turning to the barber, he said, "But mark you what she did. She gazed steadfastly upon that sham's villain face, as I now gaze upon yours. This being her noble and simple attitude, just as I stand now. Then turned she, thus, to me, and stretching her arm out, so, and pointing with her finger, she said, in that firm, calm tone which she was used to use in directing the conduct of a battle, "Pluck me this false knave from the throne." I, striding forward as I do now, took him by the collar and lifted him out and held him aloft, thus, as if he had been but a child. The house rose, shouting, stamping, and banging with their flagons, and went fairly mad over this magnificent exhibition of strength, and there was not the shadow of a laugh anywhere, though the spectacle of the limp but proud barber hanging there in the air like a puppy held by the scruff of its neck was a thing that had nothing of solemnity about it. Then I set him down upon his feet, thus, being minded to get him by a better hold, and heave him out of the window, which she bid me forbear, so by that error he escaped with his life. Then she turned her about and viewed the throng with those eyes of hers, which are the clear shining windows whence her immortal wisdom looketh out upon the world, resolving its falsities, and coming at the kernel of truth that is hid within them, and presently they fell upon a young man modestly clothed, and him she proclaimed for what he truly was, saying, "I am thy servant, thou art the king." Then all were astonished, and a great shout went up, the whole 6,000 joining in it, so that the walls rocked with the volume and the tumult of it. He made a fine and picturesque thing of the march out from the audience, augmenting the glories of it to the last limit of the impossibilities. Then he took from his finger and held up a brass nut from a bolt-head which the head ostler at the castle had given him that morning, and made his conclusion thus:
"Then the king dismissed the maid most graciously, as indeed was her desert, and, turning to me, said, 'Take this signet ring, son of the paladins, and command me with it in your day of need. And look you,' said he, touching my temple, 'preserve this brain, France has use for it, and look well to its casket also, for I foresee that it will be hooped with a ducal coronet one day.' I took the ring and knelt and kissed his hand, saying, 'Sire, where glory calls, there will I be found. Where danger and death are thickest, that is my native air. When France and the throne need help, well, I say nothing, for I am not of the talking sort. Let my deeds speak for me. It is all I ask.' So ended the most fortunate and memorable episode, so big with future weal for the crown and the nation, and unto God be the thanks. Rise, fill your flagons. Now, to France and the king, drink!"
They emptied them to the bottom, then burst into cheers and huzzas, and kept it up as much as 2 minutes, the paladin standing at stately ease the while, and smiling benignantly from his platform. End of chapter 7.
Ladies and gentlemen, please join us again next week as Radio Lillooet's special presentation of The Personal Recollections of Joan of Arc by Mark Twain continues.